Cocktail XSL podcast number 15. Often on this podcast, I either have comedians or people involved in politics, academics. But today, we've got both. A very funny comedian, but also somebody who's deeply involved in contemporary politics, Josie Long.
Have you guys met before?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where was that?
Originally at the Soho Theatre. When I returned to stand-up, and then whenever it was, 2011, 2012, I did a show where I invited young people off the circuit to appear alongside me, and Josie was one of those.
Oh, sweet. I used to be a young person, and it was great. And I didn't realise how quickly it would slip out of my hands. I remember that. It was very exciting.
Yeah. We must have met other places, other political events, I suspect.
Oh, yeah. Political meetings, sure. Sure. How are you?
I'm all right. I'm okay. Yeah. You know.
I've been really enjoying listening to the podcast, except for the episode about bullets, where and then I listened to the one after bullets, where you were like, everyone's complaining about me talking about bullets. And I was like, yeah.
Yeah.
But it was really fun. It was funny because it made me think of, like, I am somebody who really sort of has a certain a vibe as a person, and yet I really love looking at old classic cars, which is completely out of character for me. And the idea of people knowing that about me would be really, like, incongruous.
Yeah, well, you just revealed it now. What kind of classic cars are you?
What I mean is, if I see an old car from... has to be maybe 70 years old plus, I'll stop and my jaw will drop, like the French cartoon character Skunk.
Oh, Pepe Le Pew.
That's my...
Right.
What's it, Pepe Le Pew? Yeah, I'm like that, but for old cars. And I'll have to, and I'll be saying to my daughter, look, isn't it beautiful? And she'll just be like, no, this is just a car.
I don't think there's anything wrong with that, though. So you think there's, you think that would play badly with your demographic?
Oh, listen, it'd be ruinous for my brand.
Really?
No, I'm kidding. Because I don't think I have a brand.
Because cars are killing the planet, and those old ones.
And because the other people who like cars are like Jeremy Clarkson.
Oh yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Well, there are. Yeah. There are, I think, you know, there are other, you know, people. You can just regard them as art objects. Or, you know, Roland Barthes said that a famous article that he wrote about the Citroën DS said that, you know, the automobile is our version of the medieval cathedral, you know, the car is where, you know, belief and technology and faith and, you know, all intersect, really.
That's so interesting. But also it makes me think about how in a cathedral, a human being, even if you don't have any religion at all, you still feel that beautiful sense of awe and wonder. And how in a car, basically, you're reduced to being like, well, fuck you, you cut me up. You know? It's not the same.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't know whether, I think he was probably, I mean, the Citroën DS is, you know, considered by many to be the epitome of, the car as art object, really. So maybe he might not have been talking about, you know, the Nissan.
Hang on, I'm going to Google it.
Right.
Because I want to see what it looks like. Oh, okay. I mean, the DS23, I can see why. It's a cathedral, it's a cathedral.
Yeah, and it also had hydro pneumatic suspension and stuff, so it floated along, and you know.
Oh heaven! So, yeah, you're not going to be swearing at someone from that.
No, you're just going to be elegantly gliding around. But of course, it's also true that, you know, if you're in a I think particularly if you're of our persuasion, when you're in a cathedral, you are also filled with revulsion, aren't you, at the, you know, the materialism.
Of organized religion, of course.
Yeah.
So it's, we're aware you know, of the lives that were wasted in those bricks.
And the same is true of, you know, when you're in a motor car, is that the true, let's reach a consensus here. The true, you know, the true feeling person when they're in a car is both enjoying the aesthetic qualities, but also aware that, you know, the suffering that goes into it.
Alienated from one's fellow man, quite literally, by the walls of the car.
Yeah.
And I guess the Pope Mobile is where those two worlds converge. It's an ugly fucking car.
That is a funny little car, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I think he had, I mean, there was quite a few as well that he had. I don't really think he's got an electric one now than Pope Francis.
I love the idea that he's bought them on hire purchase and he just needs to keep getting a new one.
Yeah, maybe that. Yeah. Maybe if he goes to Mexico, you get like a low rider one, you know, one that kind of bounces up and down.
Smacking his head on the ceiling.
Yeah. Anywho, go back to the start. So, Josie, I mean, I'm interested. I never do any research, and I dress it up as, you know, letting the interviewee talk for themselves rather than laziness or, lack of coordination. So, I mean, I'm curious to know how you got into the business of stand-up comedy. So,
well, it was funny because I started when I was a teenager and I grew up in Orpington, and there used to be in Beckenham an art centre that used to have evening classes on, and it used to have a stand-up evening class that was run by a guy who, I was 14 and he was 27, and it was all adults. And to me, this 27-year-old guy was the wisest, oldest, sagest man I'd ever met. Even down to his tone, he was so measured and gentle. And then when I was about, he was so kind to me and he really looked after me sort of in terms of mentoring and allowing me to come back to the workshop, even though sort of I didn't really have the money to keep paying for it. And like, there were lots of adults there who were really sweet to me as well, but it was when I was about 20, 21, I was like, oh, he smokes a lot of weed. That's how he talks like that. But yeah, it was a really brilliant atmosphere because his whole ethos was like, find your own voice. And that's all you've got to do is find your own voice and mine that and develop that. So that really kind of was like the foundations of like me trying to write. But basically, I just loved comedy. Like, I feel like every comedian growing up loved comedy as a child and was obsessed with it and desperate to do it. But I was very lucky to find it because I loved performing so much but never found a good outlet. And I recently found out I've got ADHD, which has explained my whole life to me. Right. But I didn't know as a child. And actually, to find something like stand-up which allows you to kind of do so much on stage in the moment under that specific pressured condition was really perfect for me. And I think without it, I don't know whether I would, well, the pandemic has shown me that I found it much harder to be a functioning human being without it in my life. Cause it feels like such a perfect creative outlet for a certain type of brain that's good at connecting, but not necessarily good at like sitting down and focusing and doing things at the right times, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah. I have a sense that those kind of art centres and stuff have gone, really. They no longer exist. Yeah. And have they
in
general?
Yeah, a lot of them have.
Yeah.
I think it's complicated. I think there's always lots being lost, but there's also lots of interesting things going on. Like, I've got a friend who just started out doing stand-up in the pandemic, and she started out doing an online Zoom workshop with a bunch of other people who wanted to start stand-up. Right. And that was kind of, I mean, obviously you need a computer and access to the internet, but it was free and easier for them to get together and do that. And so there are sort of like lots of ways and means that I think, in spite of the sad realities of like...
Mm. I'm just interested because I was going to make a tedious left-wing point about how, yeah, they've all gone and it's a conspiracy
fucking right. It's sad. They don't want us to have any nice things.
No, they don't, do they? They're taking away the few. the few nice things that we have.
I moved to Glasgow with this utopian idea that I was leaving England and I was moving somewhere better. And I do think I love it so much. But I read this really distressing article from the leader of the, or from someone who was on the Glasgow City Council, basically saying people need to stop clinging to their beautiful libraries and they need to understand the council won't do these things for them. And I was like, my council tax is £240 a month, babe. Like, what's it like? Do some stuff for us.
Yeah, good. But that's, you know, a lot of councillors have that, you know, kind of Philistine, I think, attitude. So what? So after you went,
I like the weariness in between that. On we go, on we fucking go. Another 20 years of this shit.
It's local councillors. I mean, it's again
not all of them. That's the sad part. There's so many people who fight so fucking hard.
Well, that's the sort of in a kind of early episode of this early-ish episode of The Simpsons. Remember, Homer runs for mayor of Springfield, and his slogan is "Can't somebody else do it?" And it's sort of like, you know, I have a kind of disdain for local councillors, but I mean, you know, my kind of haughty disdain for, but I mean, I wouldn't, you know, the shit that you have to go through to be a local councillor, people moaning about their fucking bins. I mean,
every day, dog shit and potholes.
Yeah. Yeah. You'd be like, I wouldn't do that. You know, so I respect you, but I love you. I hate you. Local councillors.
Well, also, it's easy to know that. Well, it's hard. You know, it's complicated, isn't it? Because I know personally about three people who are local councillors who've done like beautiful environmental projects, and, like tried really hard, and then they still butt heads with people who are just like basically like, how can I get money from the property industry?
Yeah. You know. Yeah. Ah, it's so complicated, isn't it? The world, it's so...
It's harsh, isn't it? It is. And what's annoying is it would be so much easier if things were just very simple for comedy more than anything.
Doesn't our world depend on the awfulness of humanity? I mean, certainly my world. I mean, if we all just learned to live together, I'd be out of a job.
Imagine that. You'd have to be like, well, another show about how everything's fine.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, isn't it great, this beautiful,
you know, that joke about
building.
Sorry, you know that joke? Oh, the little boy, and he doesn't speak for 5 years, and his parents are going out of their minds. They're like, why isn't he speaking? And then they give him some soup, and he says, this soup is horrible. They say, what? Well, you could have spoke all this time. And he says, up until now, everything else has been satisfactory.
And that kid today is, I don't know.
Interesting.
Go on.
I'm sorry, I'm getting too excited.
That's all right.
Just chatting. But it makes me think of, I remember 10 years ago, people were really, really going, oh, well, the Conservatives being in is going to be really great for art. And me thinking, on balance, I would rather have schools and hospitals than a few really beautiful shows. Yeah. And how sad that is, because obviously that does render like lots of artists extinct, but I don't know.
Yeah, it's also, I think that's a bit of a kind of, that's a bit of a linear kind of view of art anyway, isn't it, really? To just say, because if you have a horrible, ghastly, repressive government. I wanted to do your etiquette, but that does bring us very neatly to the last 5-6 years that both of us were some of the few comedians, I think, who stuck with Jeremy Corbyn and, that whole project, really. And, it has, I mean, I have found the, both the hope that Jeremy offered and also the massive effort to discredit him as a artistically very, it's really inspired me to keep working, really. How's it been for you, the realization that everything, our world is even more of a lie than we thought.
I think I feel personally quite stung, because I spent the first 5 years of sort of 2010 to 2015 really, really getting to meet all these other younger people who were protesting about the rises to tuition fees, trying to stop the cuts to legal aid, like going to all these things, fighting really hard to try and kind of counteract the Conservatives, but feeling very much like, you know, I respect a lot of people in the Labour Party, but it's not for me and it's far to the right of me. And having people in the Labour Party, including Tom Watson himself, tweeting me saying, oh, I'd always thought that you should get more involved with the Labour Party. Oh, you guys should, you know, people genuinely saying, you know, get involved with the Labour Party, join in. And then when Jeremy Corbyn was on the ballot, I felt so excited because he was part of a small group of MPs who always seemed to be doing the right thing in terms of how they voted. Like, I remember in 2010 to 2015 having this joke that there was a, I didn't support a political party, I supported a football team because I supported 11 MPs that always voted the way that I thought was correct, right? And that included like Caroline Lucas in that. And it was sort of all the obvious people, you know, Diane Abbott, John McDonnell. And so I remember feeling so incredibly excited that there was an opportunity to wholeheartedly back the Labour Party because it felt so wonderful to think, wow, they've got a socialist leader who says these things about poverty and who says these things about climate change and who says these things that mean so much in that regard. And I feel like a lot of people of my generation who kind of maybe started politically, like came of age quite late really, but with 2010 and with kind of those things, really, really devoted a lot of our time in our life, not to Jeremy Corbyn, but to the idea that we might have a progressive socialist government that was free from a lot of the horrific elements of New Labour, you know, that was anti-privatisation and that wasn't going to get more embroiled in things like PFI and that wasn't going to start any illegal wars, like all these things that had happened, you know, a decade prior that had been so upsetting and alienating and dispiriting. You know, even a government like the idea that there would be a kinder immigration policy and a kinder attitude towards foreign policy and things like that, all these things, people really, really bought into that and wanted desperately to see it work. And from the outset, people responded as if it was the cult of Jeremy Corbyn, as if people were obsessed with this figure. And it was so weird because from the outset, we were all saying, this actually isn't really about him. This is about the fact that a generation of people who felt so alienated are so incredibly excited that they could affect positive change. And so it really, really feels, I still find myself processing the grief from it and the bitterness and the sadness, because in particular in 2017, I really remember realizing that a lot of people that I'd looked up to who were the generation above me in comedy actually were from really, really vast amounts of privilege or just were not willing to get on board with someone that they saw as illegitimate. And I understand that Brexit was such a seismic thing for people and they saw him as not anti-Brexit enough and all this stuff. But for me personally, when it came particularly to the 2017 election, all of us really felt like, Brexit aside, we have this incredible opportunity. And I took like something like 2 months really off of working towards my own stuff to try and work towards stuff during that election. All of us fought so fucking hard. And I remember being around older people who I do still respect, but who were very sort of like, ugh, Corbyn though, ugh, and saying, look, this is our one fucking chance. And with regard to climate change, this is our one fucking chance. Yeah. This is a chance of a lifetime. And lots of my friends, you know, we all sort of felt that nothing is ever going to be a perfect offer or an uncomplicated offer, but this was our chance. And in 2017, the thrill of that election night, when we were proved that with a positive offer, you can actually change people's minds and you can sway things. And I really naively thought the Labour Party will have to get behind them now. and the next 2 years will be plain sailing, and we will increase our polling. And, you know, after that election, we were polling at something like 42%. And then two things happened for me. In 2018, I had a baby who didn't sleep. She didn't sleep for 2 years. So there was definitely a year when I was less able to be politically engaged. But also everyone could feel that. I think everyone could feel that, like, it's not able to hold something together when the majority of the landscape around it, and indeed, like, as shown, people who worked in the leadership in 2017 in the office, maybe not the leadership office, I get so confused between
the terms. I think they work for Labour Party headquarters.
Exactly. That's what I mean. Sorry, the HQ. And I hate that, because if you make a small, if you make a small error like that, then people are like, you fucking thick idiot, you don't fucking know anything. It's like, I swear I do. It's just little things. But I remember sort of just really, that was a really shocking thing, because I wasn't really aware of, like, how hated the idea of socialism was by so many. Yeah. And I also wasn't really aware how much some members of, in particular, the Labour Party, but also people in working in the media, like, were willing to, like, in effect, wholeheartedly put their, like, chest behind Boris Johnson, knowing what he was and who he was, to try and stop this, like, very moderate change that would be beneficial for people at the bottom. And so there was stuff like that. And it was really, really heartbreaking. And I still feel very stung and very sad, because for a lot of us, like, that was a lot of our lives that we put in.
Yeah.
And I really feel like it was done not just in good faith, but very innocently and very lovingly. Like, a lot of people who were going out campaigning, we were excited to meet people, we were excited to go to different areas, to canvas, to talk to people, to do shows. I connected with so many people who were, like, beautiful retirees who spent their life working in social care, who were really, really excited, or young people who for the first time were like, wow, we could try and change things for the better. And so my experience was all of these very sincere and very positive things that are now being treated as if they didn't exist, and stuff like that. So, yeah, I feel very sad about it. And I feel, as a socialist, it's in a weird time, because for me, it was always about socialism and a better world. And I just feel sad because it's hard when you think, but it would be better. Yeah. And also, the pandemic's been brutal, because, you know, I know some people hate Jeremy Corbyn. I understand that. I will never necessarily be able to win them round or change their mind. And I'm not here to do that. I feel like it's people's right to have their own opinions and their own feelings about things to do with that. But at the same time, he would have gone to the fucking Cobra meetings, and he wouldn't have said, let the bodies pile up in the thousands. Yeah, and he wouldn't have done these things. And, like, it's hard, because you start to, like... My solution was to move out of England permanently. Like, I don't want to live in a country that hates me and my values so fucking much when they come from a real place of, like, genuine utopianism. So, but also, I don't want to sound too self-pitying. Like, I just feel sad because I think people's lives would have been made better, and I think a lot of people died in the pandemic, but a lot of people are starving. Like, it's not about, oh, this thing I love didn't happen and I'm angry, which is part of that, but it's also, like, I really feel like people worked very hard in good faith, and that was repaid with a lot of scorn, and it just makes
extraordinary.
Me
I mean, it's I mean, I think I say it's multiple. I mean, you found how many I've found personally, I suppose, how many of my friends were, you know, prepared to believe a lie, you know, but a number of lies, really, in the kind of hysterical kind of, oh, this is my party. You know, the kind of truly shocking and really very difficult to still get your head around.
But also, I'm trying to be sympathetic to people, and both you and I, prior to that, we're not, like, big fans. We weren't, like, the Labour Party is my party. And I think it must have been very, very hard for people who basically joined because of Blair.
Yeah.
So we're talking fucking 23, 24 years ago. So I think, to be fair, if you've been in that party for 20 years and your politics were those politics, you would feel like these people have stolen my thing. Now, to me, I'm like, Keir Hardie would also have some words there. But at the same time, like, I can see why people would be like, my party. And I also see that I really think that there are some people who, either because perhaps they might be quite sheltered in terms of their own personal privilege, or because they're from a certain generation where it makes sense for them to see the world a certain way. There is that whole people who are like, no, we had the end of history, we're not having any of this. And it's like,
yes,
I'm so sorry, but also climate change is happening, and also we have an authoritarian government, so unfortunately there is some more history, and we need to be radical about it.
Well, you said two things, really. That you said that, you know, people are entitled to their other opinion. I don't fucking think they are. But also, you're very kind to the right wing of the Labour Party. I think they're just intrinsically evil.
Well, I don't want to be in a party with them, and I don't ever want to associate with them, and I literally have left the country to avoid them. So it's complicated.
It's also, I mean, the entirety of the media that turned against, you know, the Corbyn Labour Party. I mean, it was truly, truly shocking, I think, and at all levels, as you know, and the pusillanimous nature of you know, comedians and those.
That was the hard part.
Satire programs
around around the 2019 election, to see things like, oh, this Corbyn supporter punched someone, or they did this, that, the other, and they were all those things were lies. And at the same time, to know that friends of mine were being physically assaulted whilst campaigning for Labour because they were saying, you're a communist. And it was like, A, I fucking wish they were communists. I haven't done the reading. Let's park that. But nonetheless, like, it was not a communist offer that was on the table in 2019.
Certainly not.
And people being beaten up for being IRA sympathisers and communists. And that is the fault or the effect of over and over again. Like, and this is the problem. What I can't cope with. But also I can't cope with the sort of falseness of the discourse, like, around, like, people saying, oh, they're an IRA sympathiser. And it's like, well, no. But at the same time, perhaps we could acknowledge that the Troubles is complicated. And perhaps we could acknowledge that the British state did commit a number of crimes which are at this very moment being covered up and people are being given immunity for. Like, so it is still remaining something that isn't as black and white as, like, if you don't support Britain, you're a terrorist. It's like, no.
But that's Albert Maysell's, you know, tyranny is the removal of nuance.
I just assumed that everyone was a comrade because I was naive and because I grew up under a Labour government. And actually, it was so shocking to be like, oh, some people want to be a comrade and a landlord and a head of a public school.
Yeah.
And they don't think that any of that is contradictory. Or some people are like, of course I'm a comrade. What does that mean? It means I'm nice and I don't want anything to change.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I think that is what, when I, you know, tried to kind of drill down into why some of my friends were so ferocious in their hatred of Corbyn and that, you know, that iteration of the Labour Party, it was because they'd gone along thinking that they were left-wing and they were decent people, and he showed them that they weren't.
People don't like being shown up. They hate it.
They'll do anything to avoid, you know, being, you know, having themselves shown to themselves, you know, and that's why there's a very good, well, I'm a sort of dangerous, a comedian has read one book, but I mean, my favorite book is a book called Mistakes Were Made But Not By Me, which is written by two social psychologists, and about how we make and justify bad decisions, you know, and it's like that thing.
Amazing. I'm going to write it down.
Yeah, it's really, I think it's good. Actually, a friend of mine funnily enough, really hated it when I recommended him, and I think it's because it showed him up. He was like, "This book," you know. My explanation is not a bad book. It just, you know, it gave him too much to think about. But it details, for instance, things like, if you remember, the satanic abuse, you know, or the moral panics, like the satanic abuse.
Do you know scandal. There's a really interesting podcast called "You're Wrong About." That's done some really, really great episodes about the satanic panic. They're two sort of left-wing academics, and they chat in a really fun, informative way about basically saying, you've been brought up to believe that this was the case for this thing. Let's examine it and debunk it. Yeah. And it's so interesting.
Yeah, of course, that would change nobody's opinion. But yeah, but I think they detail in this how in two separate incidents where US police have convicted somebody for a murder. The police who've done the convicting refuse to believe that the person they've arrested isn't guilty of murder, even though the person they're supposed to have murdered has turned up alive.
Oh, my God.
And so they go, well, you know, he probably murdered somebody else. I mean, but it's in the book. You can see where the person...
Imagine brutal it'd be. You'd be like, oh, my God, they've been found alive? I'm free. And then be like, no.
No, we're not going to let you. I mean, human beings are so resistant when they have invested so much in something, because these cops have worked to frame these fucking people. They will not, and it's not just, you know, them being exposed. It's that they cannot allow themselves to believe that the person that they've said is a murderer isn't, you know. And I think that is why I think, the kind of the ferocious rejection of Corbyn and the Labour Party by people, certainly I know, comes from that. He showed them themselves as being, you know, not who they thought they were, and they couldn't take that.
Yeah, I don't know. Because then I think, well, I was very invested in this. Do I regret investing in it? And I think I feel very sad about the fact that there was a lot of emotional fallout and that some people really hated it and were really upset. And especially when, in particular, all the people I know were fighting for something that I really do still believe in. Mm. But I don't regret trying, even though we didn't, because quite often the way people talk about this sort of thing is they go, well, you failed, so it wasn't worth trying. And it's like, and to be honest, probably destined to fail most of the fucking time in this country where, you know, most of the land is owned by 12 people and four private schools dominate everything and all the money is concentrated in the hands of a few rich aristocrats and a few rich kind of technocrats, and that's it, you know.
Yeah. Our consolation is we were right and they were wrong.
Yeah. Or at the very least, we were really fucking trying to do something to improve the lives of ordinary people. And we were really trying to change the society into a more caring, more imaginative and more supportive one. That's what we were trying to do.
And what did we get for that? Rubbles.
Toxic slime on fire.
They tried to ban my desert island discs.
Well, to be fair, your musical choices are shocking. No, I haven't heard it yet.
What do you want to talk about now, Jo? Do you want to talk a bit more about your work?
My work. I've done fuck all. I want to talk about you and your writing, and I want to talk to you because... So what I'm trying to do at the moment is I'm writing a book of short stories, and it's something I've been wanting to do since I was a teenager or since prior to that. And I really remember how much I loved when I first read your short stories, and I read your... Pardon me, which one is it? It's here. Oh, for fuck's sake. And your novel and your first novel. I hate sort of giving compliments because then I feel like I'm going to make a mistake and seem like I don't care.
For the first collection of short stories was Whilst Leonard Plays. The second selection was The Dog Catcher, and then the first Overtaken. Novel was Overtaken.
Yes, those three books had such an incredible effect on me because it was so exciting to read the voice of someone whose work I really loved, but in a new medium. And I really loved like how much broader they were in terms of, obviously, because it's not just stand-up, you can do so much more and you can give so much more to it. And basically, like, I just wanted to talk about it because I've been trying to write my own things and I've been finding it a thrill, but also finding it so difficult. And and just like what it was like for you, like that journey when you decided you were going to do it, whether it was something you did always do as well, like how it, I just want to talk more about it, but not for it to be too artificial.
Right. No, fine. So you interview me on my podcast. No.
Yeah,
why not? It's mine. Linda says sometimes that you could argue that the novel, and I would include the short story in that, you know, is the highest form of art in a way, because what you do in a novel is that you set up this entirely coherent work. And the only way that you can, the most profound understanding that we can get of the human condition is through novels. I mean, something like Anna Karenina, for instance, or Dickens, I guess, or I'm not particularly expert on Dickens. But, and so it's a really powerful written prose. I think prose fiction is a tremendously powerful form because you can very quickly, I think, particularly in short stories, build this entirely coherent world, and you can cover so much ground that, as you say, you can be, and I think you're right to focus on those three books. I'm not sure that I mean for a lot of different reasons that I could kind of carried on down that road, but those three books are, I'm very proud of them, and I think they're great. And they do what you say they do, that they kind of, that they're both funny, but I'm talking about how great I am.
No, but I like it. Do you know what, as well, for me the real pleasure in writing short stories is when you're writing stand-up, I think the job is to undermine constantly so that people are aware that even though you are making serious points about politics or humanity, that you also are puncturing your own self so that you're not, you're going, oh yes, and actually I'm really, I understand that and I think it's important, but in a short story, you don't need to be like, let's pop the air out of this. You can just be like, no, this is a story that I'm writing and I'm sincere in it. And here it is, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, two things there. Yes, I mean, I think that's a very profound thing that you say about doing stand-up, that it, certainly the kind of stand-up we do, that, you have to constantly remind the audience that you're, to undermine yourself constantly. And, yes, you don't, there's no requirement to do that in prose fiction. Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And did you always want to do it? Did you do it when you were a kid as well?
It's a long time since I've talked about this. I mean, I had a phase of teaching writing, creative writing and stuff. So I could give you a much more kind of composed and thought through response, really. So now this will be more kind of tentative, really, when I say it. So I need to think back to what I used to think. I never really, when I was doing stand-up, I would try and write prose fiction. And what I found was that there's a brilliant film which is about writing called Wonder Boys. It's, I think it's Curtis Hanson. It stars Michael Douglas and Frances McDormand. One of the things it's about, I'm sort of spoiler alert, but one of the things is that Michael Douglas plays this novelist who has had a huge hit first novel and then is struggling with his second novel. And you think in the normal manner of these things that he's blocked. But when finally a young student played by Katie Holmes reads his manuscript, you realize that he's not writing too little, that he's writing too much. And there's a brilliant line which goes something like, she says, You know that professor when you write about, like, all the characters and all the characters' horses? and then she says, and the horse's teeth? It's like, this, you know, it's what people, you know, when you're teaching creative writing, say writing is all about making choices. And she says, you have not made any choices. You have not. And that's what I found in a way, that I couldn't make those choices. I didn't know what to. Somebody goes through a door. Do you talk about the door handle? You know, do you talk about the hinges? You know, and I found when I tried to write prose fiction that. And what suddenly changed when I started writing Barcelona Plates in 1999 was that somehow that a certainty had appeared where I knew I didn't have those questions anymore. I'd had kind of achieved a kind of a very spare style, and I put that down, whether or not it's true, I put that down to the fact that I've been doing a lot of journalism. Column writing, and when you write a column, you know, you have to be precise, because if you didn't get your column down to exactly 850 words, the sub editors would edit it, and they would often edit out the jokes in favor of facts, because they were obsessed with facts. So you know, you make it, you know, it was, so you really needed to be precise. I mean, obviously, not everybody can. Well, including me anymore, could have a column in a national newspaper. So, you know, that route to precision. But that is, I think, partly it's making those choices about what you want to describe. And I developed a kind of very spare style, which I think suited the kind of coldness and cynicism of my literary universe.
But I think as well, for me, like the sparser the writing, the more it can sort of magically give you a full world. Like, I don't want something that's big lists about the fucking curtains and shit.
Yeah.
I want to feel emotionally like I love Jean Rhys, and I feel like she's so good at being like giving you two sentences and you're like, I'm in the room, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. It is. And somebody like Philip Roth, who is an author that I admire tremendously, also I think went through good phases and bad phases, which I think in itself is interesting. But there's there's probably, he is somebody who's, there is more and more, as the years go on, there is more and more objectionable stuff in his fiction. But there's a bit in Sabbath Theatre where he clearly, one of the characters is like an heiress or an heir to a glove making, and you can think he's thought, I've done this fucking research, I'm going to put it in. And there's five fucking pages about how you make gloves. And it's like, fucking, you know, mate.
No,
you know, I'm sorry you had to spend all that time in the library, but, you know, or talking to glove makers. But really, this is not getting us anywhere, you know. And it's just...
I get too excited. That's a funny thing with stand-up. I've definitely had it in the past where I've wanted to write stand-up about science or whatever, and I've done so much reading, and the joke has been something really silly and obvious, and I've just known that I've just, all of that reading did get me there, but I can't showcase it.
No. And it's frustrating, isn't it?
Yeah. When you're like, right, so the joke is me hitting my head, is it? Great.
But, you know, that's what you got to do. You got to kind of make that sacrifice, I think, you can't, you know, all that research will, I mean, I'm not a great one for doing research. I'd rather, given that it's fiction, I'd rather make it up, make shit up rather than, like, do extensive, you know, spend a lot of time in the British Library. But you know, even if you do, then... that will inform, you know, what you've written, but for fuck's sake, don't put it in the book.
Done that research, but it's under the surface. The iceberg.
It will be there. But I mean, so I think that you know, I was very fortunate, certainly with those three books, to have found that precision, really.
And do you feel like you have aspirations in the future, maybe aspirations are the wrong word, plans in the future to write more kind of stories and fiction, or do you feel like that's something you did and you did it?
It's complicated, really, because, I mean, I think that this, you know, it was, there is, I mean, the friends of mine who were serious authors, it used to drive them nuts that there was a time when any arsehole comedian was getting a book deal, you know.
Oh, that's still the case, but everyone's writing memoirs.
Is it? Oh, yeah, well, that's what happened to me as well. Yeah, but there was a point when everybody was writing fiction, like, who played Dr. House? What's his fucking name?
Oh, Hugh.
Hugh Laurie wrote a novel.
And what's funny about that is, to me, I'm like, I know Hugh Laurie is very privileged, but he's never said anything egregious and he seems a good sort. And I feel like you'll be like, I've got dirt on him from 1979.
Now he's one of the better ones.
He seems like a good sort.
Yeah, no, he is. He's a great actor as well, but his novel is fucking shit.
Oh.
That's so interesting, because I've really felt with writing these stories, I thought, gosh, I don't know many other comedians, if any, who currently write. Oh, no, well, Mark Watson writes loads of fiction. He's written loads of brilliant novels, but lots of people aren't really. And I thought, oh, how lucky I will be writing these short stories and no one else would be doing it. And so actually it's quite funny to think, oh, 15 years ago the trend was that everyone was. And also, to be fair, my friend Izzy Sooty's just written a brilliant novel. So actually, my point is completely disproved.
Because the other thing was then, which I think has changed since, massive advances. I mean, massive.
What, back then? Yeah, I often think the 90s was a wonderland of people being given money up front.
Yeah.
Everyone loves a windfall. And everyone loves the idea that their life might change due to some wonderful gift to do with art. It's interesting. Do you know what I keep thinking about is that Andrew Lawrence, who's this racist guy who used to be a comedian. And when he was a comedian about 15 years ago, we were starting at the same time. And I won a newcomer prize that he was nominated for. And he was very bitter about it. And he was very, very annoyed that I existed and that I'd got in the way of his rightful crown. And then afterwards, there was a DVD company. And at that time, they used to do DVD deals for comedians that were sort of high five-figure, sometimes six-figure deals, where they'd say, we're going to develop you and we're going to do your DVDs. And he got one of these really good deals for a lot of money. I don't know how much. It could have been 10 grand. It could have been 100 grand. But it was, at the time, a world-changing amount of money. And my manager got a meeting with them and they said, women don't sell DVDs. There's no way we would give a woman a DVD deal. And then 10 years later, he was like, women have stolen all of our work. And I've never forgotten. I've been like, give me the fucking money then, mate.
Yeah. You bastard. Yeah.
But that was the last of it in comedy, I think, was that kind of thing.
Yeah, the DVD money. Well, I think in a way, it was a plot really to, apart from certain favoured artists, it was a plot to kind of cut the artist, cut the talent out of them, off from the money supply really, and to redistribute it to, commissioners, producers, anybody but the talent really, I think. Yeah, so there was a brief golden age when actors and, when there was all that, like you say, DVD money and royalties and big advances for writing fiction were sloshing about, but I think that's gone now. I've forgotten what point we were talking about.
We were talking about how there was a trend where everyone seemed to be writing a novel.
Yes.
But I'm sure you didn't see yourself like that.
No, I worry that I didn't. I, in a way, wasn't in it for the long haul, really. And certainly, I worry sometimes that the fact that my going back to stand-up comedy coincides with that period of generosity ending, but I was really only in it for the first class train travel up to Leeds to do a reading to 20 people in a Waterstones. It was heaven. It was and you'd do lovely. You'd have these as publicists, boys or girls, and they'd be paid to think that you were wonderful, and they were just full of hope and optimism, and then you'd go up to Leeds together, and then you'd have the finest wines known to humanity in Malmaison in Leeds after the book reading to 40 nutcases. And it was just a very heaven to be alive. But I then did a couple more novels. I think one of the things that did spoil me for writing fiction, although it did a lot for my book sales, was writing memoir. That I've got two, very successful volumes of memoir.
Well, listen, we've got them in our house. Johnny, it was the joy. It was the joy of his holiday.
Well, you've added back. Yeah. Well, but the trouble with that is it fucks you for writing fiction in a way, because with memoir, you don't have to think what happened, because what happened happened. Yeah. You don't have to. I mean, obviously memoir is a kind of fiction, but and I think that ruined me for writing fiction. I have a novel that I've had on the go for 20 years, and I was kind of tinkering. One of the problems with it is that when it's spread over that long, what you're interested in changes and stuff. So I go back to it and it's like, why do I?
It's like Lanark. Have you read Lanark?
The Scottish
Alistair
author.
Graham,
his name?
Yeah.
Alistair Graham, yeah. No, I haven't.
Alistair Graham. He basically, you feel, he wrote it over, I think, maybe 20 years, maybe slightly less, but I think it was around that time.
Yeah.
And you feel it. You feel like this person is a different person. And it's good. I think he manages it very well. It's different books, different things happen in those books, but it sort of gives it this effect of like this sort of tumbling, disorientating process of life slipping between your fingers.
David Hockney had said a really interesting thing, which was that a painting is a work of art which happens over time. Whereas a photograph or a movie or this podcast, it's happening as it's happening, as it were. Whereas the moment, the single moment that's being represented in a painting, in fact, has taken months or years, and that makes it a very different object. Something that never occurred to me, really. But that had been, it's a very different object. And I suppose you could say that about certainly a novel as well, that although it represents, in a sense, a series of moments, the author has written it over a much longer, over a long period of time, generally. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, I think. So, I have this novel that I keep returning to, whether or not I will ever finish it, I don't know. But that's really the sum. In terms of fiction, I've got, I've got several TV development things, that may or may not ever happen. But I feel slightly shifty that I abandoned writing. But they could have been nicer to me, I think, at those festivals. They could have, if they'd given me, a fucking Booker, I think a Booker long list nomination.
Then you would have thought, fine.
Then I would have gone, fine, you're my friend, I love you, I'll stay with you for the long haul.
Get enough prize.
Even though the big advances have gone. Yeah, I will be your mate. If Ian McEwan had only been nicer to me.
Yeah, but you've read his books. He doesn't seem sometimes people tell you who they are and you have to believe them,
But I would have stuck with them, but instead I drifted back to comedy, really. But yeah, it's a tremendous art form, and I do feel a bit shifty that I walked away from it.
But it must have felt that, I don't know, it must be that you were drawn to it for that reason. You contributed that, and then you'd done that, and so you were no longer drawn to it in the same way.
Yeah, I think so. And I think in a way, I came to realise that I was a comic, really, that that's who I am, and that was who I had to be, really. But you can't be a comic. It's not a kind of, that's also true of writing. When I was teaching writing, I used to say, you can't be you can't theoretically be a writer. A writer is somebody, it's a statement of the obvious, but a writer is somebody who writes. Yeah. You have to write.
I know, but the allure of being a writer is so.
Yeah, and I think there are people like who just like the idea of being a writer, I think, rather than doing the work. But it's also a thing. I think there is a thing where, I used to say in my writing classes that, there's only kind of one way to be a pilot, really, is to take off and then land and fly for a bit, Whereas, there are a million ways to be a writer, really. Your working method
And, you know, the way you approach it can be entirely idiosyncratic. You know, you can work on a computer, you can work on...
And it can change.
You
can
write with a pen. Yeah.
That's what blows my mind is when I was younger, I really thought I can only write at night. And actually it was like, I'm only allowing myself to concentrate at night, you know.
Yeah.
Or it was like, no, I write by hand, longhand. And then it was like, oh, actually I write on the computer. You know, I never take notes. Yeah. I only take notes. And that sort of shocks me. Here's the thing I want to ask, because I've been doing stand-up for 20 years now, which on stage I'll say because I started before I was born and then all that kind of stuff. But I've been doing stand-up for 20 years now, and I do feel like if you are a stand-up, if you love it, you are stuck with it for life. It is so, like, it grafts itself onto your heart, and that is you lost forever to it. And like you tried to get away, you couldn't. You had to come back. Yeah. 10 years, you thought you were out the game. No,
17 years.
You'd get less for most crimes. 17 years. You thought you were out. It fucking pulled you back in. And I feel very happy with that state of affairs. Like, I love the idea of, you know, Phyllis Diller doing stand-up in her 80s, and the idea that you could, as long as you can get to the microphone, do your stand-up, and as long as hopefully you are, one is compos mentis, it's all right, you know. But at the same time, I do feel like I'm only 2 decades in, and sometimes I look at how I felt the first 10 years of doing it, where everything seemed to be following a path and making sense, and all of my work fitted nicely in my head, and it made sense to me and felt good, and like it was coherent and clear. And then the longer I'm in the game, the more it just feels like this, because obviously life isn't really that. I just feel so like it's this soup, and it's really hard sometimes to keep clarity and make sense of it and feel like I can create direction and create a kind of nice little chart for, like, not just be a little boat in the middle of the seas. Do you know what I mean?
And like,
how does it work decade on decade?
Well, kind of like that. It never, I mean, I've got no words of encouragement or reassurance for you.
What use are you?
None. Not as a, well, apart from to, you know, apart from to point out these things.
Well, doesn't it hark back to what your first stoner stand-up teacher said, is like, just keep harnessing your voice, and your voice might change, like you were saying. I'm not trying to educate you, but I'm just bouncing back.
This is what I want.
I'm just bouncing back what you've actually said, but like, you know, your voice changes, your methods change, but then just stay true to whatever that is.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'll go then, shall I?
I'm kidding. I'm sorry.
I'm going to give much more negative advice. Yeah, I mean, well, my own experience was that I, without really realizing it, that I'd reached the end of the road with the first iteration of my stand-up, The Man in the Tight Suit. And I was becoming very unhappy with the shows I was doing, really. And I think that was, to a degree, that was perhaps reflected in my performance. Well, I was still, you know, selling out big venues and well, occasionally selling out big venues. Sometimes booking big venues and having to move everybody from the balcony into the stores.
Oh, yeah.
But
listen, we've all had our show demoted to a foyer.
Yes, I have. I've had that. Yeah. So I was very, and I just kind of stopped really, and that's when I got into, and that was gradually when I became an author for, you know, sort of 15 years and stuff. And that gave me the time and the space to work out. And actually what helped me find the second version of my stand-up was doing book readings and the kind of anecdotal material that I would do. And I found that I could talk as myself rather than this guy in the tight suit. I could talk as Alexei, that this was Alexei. And so I would tell stories about my own life. So writing gave me two things really, which was that it gave me ultimately my performance method, but it also gave me the breathing time. And, you know, it gave me a chance to write some really great books. I think you have to sometimes just take, you know, you, I mean, it's a difficult, it's, I mean, particularly with comics, it's true of anybody. It's this road that you come to where you, and you see it with comedians over and over again. They sometimes, you know, where that you think, should I keep doing the thing that I'm doing? It used to work, you know, it's made me rich, or it's made me famous, or it's given me an audience. This thing that I used to do, this kind of material, used to work, so I'm going to keep doing it. And even if it's not working, I'll just hope ultimately that it'll come, it'll somehow revive itself. And certainly my feeling was, no, you have to stop, you have to bin everything that, and this is not, I'm not saying this is a universal lesson, but for me, you have to bin everything really and ultimately start again. The worst thing you can do is to keep doing the same thing that you were doing, really, without letting it evolve.
Yeah.
Because it used to work.
And that's scary. But it's important.
It is scary, yeah. And, you can see some certainly big-name comics that, you know, fall into that trap, really.
And for me, I think stand-up is in and of its time so much that if you don't move along so quickly, you'll find that what you're saying doesn't land and doesn't make sense because it's from another world, even two, 3 years down the line.
And I think I did find that was one of the reasons for my dissatisfaction, in a way, that because, you know, the world had changed and I was still this, you know, shouting about, you know, berating the audience about their failings, and they would think, well, I don't have to put up with that. I can go and have my prejudices reinforced by Frank Skinner. I don't need to listen to this man yelling at me, confronting me.
Yeah, it's interesting.
And so that, you know, it, you know, I felt it was, I was kind of giving the wrong, I was at odds. It was still, you know, there was still an enthusiastic audience, but I just felt I was slightly at odds with the zeitgeist. Yeah. And so eventually it wasn't a coherent process, but it was just a kind of longish process of disillusion, you know, where I finally kind of ground to a halt in Perth, Western Australia.
Well, like many have before you.
Yeah. But that's the game, you know. I mean, it's tough, you know, it's a tough old game, really.
And do you feel like, as a creative person, the key is like always having that energy to kind of reinvent yourself? Or do you feel like it's never a case that you're going to be able to be like, now we sit back and relax?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you can for a while, you know, but you have to be, you can.
You've got five years to sit on the laurels. Then the laurels are all burned. You got to fucking go again, build up more. I mean, that does make sense. Like, you know, you build up your little store of nuts. The nuts are all gone. Yeah. You got to go out, build up an entirely new...
Yeah, but you think there's a while there when you can gorge on those nuts. You're like, oh, yeah, this is, you know,
I'm having a great this is the good time. Life. I really remember that. I did 3 Edinburgh shows at The Fringe and they all got nominated for the award 3 years in a row. And I remember thinking, I finally proved myself. And now I'm like, none of that matters to anyone. No one gives a shit. Time has passed. And that's where that's how it is.
Yeah, the only, well, you know, I mean, particularly I think because what you're doing is challenging anyway. So it's not, the only people for whom time doesn't pass are people who, you know, profoundly kind of support the status quo.
It'll be fun, though. Do you ever think we could just reinvent ourselves as people who love the Queen? Just do a show. God bless you, Mom. We could do a show called God Bless You, Mom.
Yeah.
Oh, it'd be so... We'd be
welcome as penitents, wouldn't we? You know, we'd be
even better that we'd swap sides.
Yeah, yeah. All this woke bollocks is fucking. We could go on GB News.
Oh God, imagine! Do you know it would be so heartbreaking for me? There's a few people, and I really like, you're one of a few people that I really regard in sort of a certain place in comedy. Yeah. And if you were suddenly, cancel culture, I'd be like, oh, no, no, another one bites the dust.
Well, I think I've sort of half-heartedly tried over the years to do it. And it just, it's so against my nature that it just, I just do something. You know, I talked, when I did a sitcom in the States, a network sitcom, and my behavior, because I was so conflicted about doing it and because it was so shit, my behavior was so bizarre that every day I would come in and do something nuts because I was so angry with myself for being in this shit fucking,
I understand that,
you know, show. So disgusted with myself that I would do, you know, I would just do insane things, really. And you know, which had in the end the result that I got fired.
But this is an interesting thing because finding out I had ADHD, it's an interest-based nervous system. So you cannot motivate yourself to do things as a means to an end. And you cannot motivate yourself to do things that other people tell you are good for you. You can't, like, I used to be really proud of myself because I'd be like, I never, ever choose things for the money. I only choose things for love. And I used to think that was some kind of achievement on my part. And when I found out I had ADHD, I was like, oh, that's just literally, it's impossible to do otherwise. Yeah, it's just brain chemistry. There's nothing special about me. If anything, I've hindered myself by not being able to make a plan and follow steps. And like, it's a similar thing. It's like some part of you was like, I will not do this thing that does not fit in with me, no matter fucking what.
Absolutely. I mean, it was,
I wanted to ask you earlier, how do they diagnose that? Is it like a questionnaire or is it a blood test or?
It was, for me, it was the pandemic that really did it for me. Frustratingly, because I actually had issues at primary school. I had issues at university. I there's been lots of times when, had there been the diagnosis around, it would have changed my life for the better. But what happened was when the pandemic occurred, all the things that I built up that made me a productive human being, like scheduling in stand-up shows, touring them, all the ways that I'd found to kind of build a life that worked for my brain were taken away. And being stuck in the house is kind of horrific to someone like me because I'm not somebody who can just go, right, well, I'll set myself a schedule and I'll follow it every day and I'll motivate myself to do this, that, the other. I need very specific kind of motivations that are like praise and shame, like strong things, dread, you know, and actually I need external things to motivate me quite a lot of the time. And so being trapped in the flat, having so much uncertainty, I was desperate to write my stories, but I couldn't get the confidence to do it in those circumstances. I felt totally adrift. And basically I was like, my brain is breaking. What's going on? And I saw a friend who's a comic book artist talking on his social media about how he'd been diagnosed with ADHD and what he'd been going through. And everything he said, I related to so intensely. And then this is so pathetic, but he shared a lot of meme accounts on Instagram. These are like people putting together funny things saying, you know, you have ADHD when XYZ, or me, an ADHD person doing XYZ. And again, it was this feeling of every single one of these I relate to. And then there's a website called attitude.com. And I took a few questionnaires on that. And again, it was like, and then I remembered that in my early 20s, people used to take the piss out of me and say I had ADHD as a joke. And I used to be like, ha, ha, ha. And at the time, people felt it was something you grew out of. They didn't appreciate that it was kind of a neurodiversity thing. So basically, all those things came together. And I eventually ended up doing an online consultation with a doctor, with a psychiatrist. And my sister had to fill out a questionnaire and my partner had to fill out a questionnaire and I had to fill out a questionnaire. And basically, it was hilarious. After about like 10 minutes, he was like, I mean, yeah, you've obviously got ADHD. And I was like, oh, okay.
Oh my God, because this is fucking, I think I'm mirroring your experience. Oh, this is something that explains so much about my life.
So many creative people. And I also particularly think in stand-up is a magnet to people with that kind of a brain, because a lot of these things that in lots of other places are weaknesses become strengths. We can't cope with a 9-to-5 regular routine. That's fine. It's never the same day twice. That's perfect. It's a lot of stress, but actually a lot of focus on stage. That's perfect. Yeah. Our brains are wired to make unusual, fast connections, which is what jokes are, which is what improvising jokes are. So actually all of these things, which really are a hindrance in an office or really are a hindrance in like the square world, are this superpower for stand-up a lot of the time. So there you go.
And then how does a diagnosis help?
Well, for me, it's frustrating because I'm pregnant at the moment, so I can't really take the medicine. They have there's stimulant medication and non-stimulant medication. And one of the things that women in particular suffer from is like the emotional effects of ADHD, where you dwell a lot on things you've said and done. You're very sensitive. There's a thing called rejection sensitivity dysphoria, which means I've had a lot of like really bad and extreme trolling online, but there are many people who would not be as painfully affected by that as me. And one of the reasons is this ADHD stupid brain.
Right, okay.
So basically I would hope when I've had my baby that I can go on some medication that helps with those things. So you can get medication, but it's not just that. It's once you understand it, I think having the diagnosis is so helpful. You feel like you can see yourself through a lens and then you can find the tools to help yourself better, as opposed to just going, I'm awkward and weird and I don't fit in, what's wrong with me? Which was a lot of my life.
Yeah. But isn't this just like adding labels to things that are just people being weird and stupid unnecessarily?
Listen, I fucking love the fact that I now feel part of a community who understand me. And also, I look around and 60% of my friends have it. My partner has it. And I see why I was attracted to these people, because I'm like, they understand the world. And I used to think, oh, it's squares, not like me. And now I'm like, neurotypical is neurodiverse. Yeah.
Wow.
Well, we reached the natural end.
Yeah, that's lovely. Okay.
We could go on all day. Really.
Thanks for having me. I hope I wasn't too overbearing.
No, it was fantastic. It was really fantastic. I'm not just saying.
That was really fucking cool. Glad.
Look at my face and this little.
Oh, that's
look
nice.
At the honesty in my
that's
face.
Nice.
I want to, before we go, this might not stay in, but I just want to try something. It will take 2 seconds before you go. But basically, a bunch of episodes ago, something came up in the show, and it's kind of off brand. It's kind of off. It doesn't really suit what we do on the show. I'm trying my best to figure out a way to give these fucking prizes to some listeners. Yeah, I've got five of these little Lego Alexis.
I'll have one. Yeah. I've got a 3-year-old. She'll love it.
What? Give them to a guest? I've already got five of them. No, but we've already said on the show that we're going to come up with a way to decide who deserves them. Should we just give them to our guest, Alexi?
I'm a listener. I've listened to the podcast.
You let her have one of the Lego. Don't be a bastard.
Well, I'll give one to you, Alexi, one to Josie. Then we've got three left. I'm keeping one if you guys are getting one.
I deserve a seat on the lifeboat.
So what, should we just fuck off the audience and keep them ourselves?
Yeah.
Okay, this is what I would say. If people want one of...
Celebrity.
If people want a Lego Alexi, what they should do is they should try to make a piece of beautiful art from their enjoyment of the podcast. And then they should either send it or send you a photograph of the beautiful art. And then not only will you be able to look at some beautiful art, but you can choose your favourites and reward them with the Lego.
Oh, wow. Fan art competition. I love it. All right.
Yeah.
Good for the brand.
Yeah.
This is great. Okay, cool. Thank you so much. We'll post all the fan art on our Instagram account.
Yeah, don't send it physically, but take a photo.
Alexis L Podcast. Send them to us at alexislpodcast@gmail.com or message us on Instagram at alexislpodcast. While we're here, I'm on Instagram at Talalaban, so follow me too.
I'm on Instagram at Josie Long. I rarely post.
There we go. I love your feed. I love your... You post a lot more on your stories than on your feed, and I really it. It's like,
my stories are just me sharing anti-capitalist meme accounts for fun, so that's good too.
It's really fun. When you're stuck on a train and you're like, I'm on a train for 4 hours, ask me questions and stuff. I like that. That's it. Okay.
Thank you very much, Josie.
Thanks for having me.
Very, 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 very much. No, it's brilliant.
It's exciting to get to talk to you and to ask you my pre-prepared questions about your work and career. But it really is for
maybe
me.
Maybe if I'm up in Glasgow, we can...
Come on. We should come and stay with me and Johnny. We've got a spare room. If you're up doing a gig, come and stay. We'll make you dinner. We'll give you the finest wines.
A choice of...
And you can drink them alone. As I'm pregnant and he's sober, but you can drink alone.
I'm fine with that.
Cool. All right, listen, we'll all right. See you soon. Bye,
thank
guys.
You, Josie.
Thank you very much, Josie. Thank you very, very much.
That was wicked. She's so cool.
Yeah.
This is, it's like a match made in heaven, you two chatting together. It was really nice, really refreshing to find a comrade comedian. And I'm so glad I asked her about the Lego things, man, because that's going to give me something to put on the Insta feed, because it's, I struggle to know even what to bloody post on that thing. So that's really cool. And
all right. Well, there you go.
Yeah, that was long enough for you listeners. No time for emails today, but do keep them coming.
All right, bye-bye. You've been listening to the Alexis L podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkouti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Anthony Overton for the sound mixing. And to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexislpodcast@gmail.com. And if you want to support this project, you can go over to our Patreon and subscribe whatever figure you deem appropriate every month. And that'll keep me, if you don't want to see me juggling outside Leicester Square Odeon or appearing on Midsummer Murders, then you really need to subscribe to the Patreon page. Thank you. I've already been in Casualty. Pay for this shit. I mean, what more do you want of me? What more do you people want? No, it's my favourite line. You know, I'm a big fan of the Bourne films. And in the first, in the Bourne Identity, Clive Owen, who plays the hitman, also known as the Professor, he's trying to kill Jason Bourne in a field in France somewhere. And he says, you know, do you get the headaches? And he says, yeah. He says, look what they make us give. I always think of that. Look what they make us give. Look what you people make me give. You can find it at patreon.com/AlexisLPodcast. Thank you.